And I think there's something about running. I often joke that my inner critic can't keep up with me because he's not fit enough. So I have freedom of thought. But I think there is a physiological effect from running. And just before I went running, someone sent me a link to a podcast. And I'm not, again, I'll say this to you guys, I'm not anti-podcast. What provoked my thought pattern was the amount of podcasts that are exactly the same. And I just thought, oh, not another one. And it was some podcast on leadership hacks. And I just thought, what would the opposite of a podcast be? Why are we so obsessed with downloading distraction rather than stuff that is actually nutritional? It's like just like eating fast food all the time. And it always starts like that. So the thought pattern is, what would the opposite of a podcast be? What would be nothing? What if you could download nothing? Yeah, you could download nothing, like that John Cale record that was 4:33 or whatever it was. And wouldn't it be brilliant if there's a podcast that just had nothing on it?
Gleich geht's los mit On the Way to New Work und hier kommt etwas in eigener Sache. Wir werden einen kompletten Relaunch des Podcasts aufsetzen. Das heißt, wir setzen uns wirklich jetzt ran und machen alles einmal neu und wir brauchen eure Hilfe oder die von euch Lust haben, uns zu helfen. Wir haben eine Befragung aufgesetzt, weil wir nicht alles aus den Zahlen rauslesen können und wir so viel Feedback von euch bekommen, sammeln wir das jetzt einmal strukturiert und der Link dafür ist relaunch.otwtnw.de, also ein Sublink, der euch dann zu SurveyMonkey führt, wo es die Befragung gibt, dauert nicht mal ganz 5 Minuten und wäre eine Riesenhilfe für uns. Wir haben das auch auf der normalen On the Way to New Work Website verlinkt, dort findet ihr das. Und wir saßen mit dem ganzen Team von den Podstars zusammen, meinem Team bei Blackboard, was den Podcast betreut, Michael und ich, und haben echt intensiv drüber gesprochen. 3 Jahre sind jetzt ins Land gegangen und wir wollen alles einmal neu machen. Und wie gesagt, macht mit, gibt uns Input, Feedback, alles, was wir brauchen, geht auf relaunch.otwtnw.de. Ruhm und Ehre für den und diejenige, die die Sachen reinbringt, die ihr nachher vielleicht live seht. Und lasst uns auch gerne wissen, wenn wir Zitate oder Ähnliches von euch teilen dürfen. Große Freude, wenn ihr dabei seid. Danke für die Riesenhilfe und jetzt viel Spaß mit der neuen Folge.
Cool. So, here we are again. Monday morning, Hamburg and UK. I don't know exactly where you're living, Steve.
I'm just outside of London.
Outside of London.
Yeah, just outside.
So welcome to the On the Way to New Work podcast. I'm sitting here with co-host
Christoph Magnussen.
And my name is Michael Trautmann. And we are in a video chat together with Steve Chapman from somewhere around London. Hi.
Yes, hi there. Lovely to see you both.
Lovely to see you again. So we had a first contact last week and I will tell the full story. So one of my best friends, Alex, who lives in San Francisco, did send me a link to one of your articles. I don't know, even remember which one it was because I read many of them and said, Michael, you have to get this guy onto your show. And I'm so thankful that he's always sending me interesting stuff, but this one was special and I'm so happy to have you here. And Christoph, I think... has the same.
The same. Michael's pitch was that you're a version of my older brother, nice. Of me, and I'm very curious to see what the future is holding for me. So that was the pitch.
So the title of the show is a blind date with my older brother. Yeah. So we in Corona times we always start with the question, how are you right now?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. Right now, I've sort of found a weird creative sweet spot in this lockdown because I can just shut myself in this studio and make things. And the only things that irritate me are neighbors making too much noise in their garden, which that's a first world problem, isn't it?
Yes.
I'm doing well, just sitting and making. And I come up here at about 6:15 in the morning. I never normally get up that early. And then I'll just draw or make and that's it. And before I know it, it's 6:00 and I should probably go back in the house and see the family.
Cool.
Okay. It definitely sounds like an older version of me. I get that. So see, for everyone who does not know you, who you are, like, who are you right now and how did you become that person? Because I definitely now am curious to get to know you a bit more.
Right. I mean, I often start keynote talks by just saying, I find introductions so difficult. And I feel for the people that introduce me at things because I don't know how to describe myself. And I'm 47 this year. And there's part of me that thinks by now you should be able to describe yourself. But I quite like not being able to. And what I often say is when I'm forced to give an answer, I say I'm an artist, a writer, a philosopher and speaker with no formal training or qualifications in any of those subjects. So I sort of like to regard myself as a professional outsider, really.
That is so cool.
I can feel it.
But yeah. I have to go back to last week when I asked you the same question. And you started your story when you went to what we call Grundschule. I think you call it elementary school.
Yeah.
And you started it that you, at this time, you were an author, an illustrator, and a DJ, and that you had teachers who could see this within your personality and that they made you stronger. And I thought, wow, what a cool start into life. But then after leaving elementary school, what happened?
Yeah, I mean, that was, again, I think I'm returning back to that. I think I'm regressing to age 11 at the moment. Because it was that I was a DJ in my bedroom. I'd record radio shows on a little tape recorder and play records in this old record player I had. And I'd write short stories. And it was those teachers would say, these stories and illustrations are brilliant. Why don't you read them to the younger children? So we used to do that. And then I'm always careful to caveat this, that I'm not knocking school worldwide, but my experience of secondary school was that I arrived and no one was really interested in any of the things that I was. They were the things that I thought were my superpowers at about age 11. And I learned very early on in school that they're not superpowers, they're hobbies for the weekend or they're dangerous distractions because there's important work to be done. And again, I spoke to you in the call, is I didn't realise to my mid-30s that I'm somewhat dyslexic. So I can read and write, but there's certain ways that information doesn't go in or stick. And I think in tangents and patterns. So to sit in a classroom being taught to memorize stuff, and I have no short-term memory, in a way that I found incredibly dull, just, I think that's what was really interesting about that is most people will blame the school system, but the type of person I am, I'd blame myself. So I think I'm just not cut out of this. I'm thick. I can't do this. And I left school at age 18. And didn't go to university and got a job in a factory. So it was something happened for me in that period that was probably partly me, but also the school system that I was exposed to that's designed for one way of learning.
What role did your parents play during this time? Did they help you in any way, or were they did they get the real story behind not good? What was their role?
That's a fascinating question because both my parents, my family's a working class background. So my dad was, you could describe him as an entrepreneur. His first job was a window cleaning business. And then I mainly remember him being a London bus driver when I grew up. My mum used to be a typist, I think, and she gave up work when I was born. And both of them left school when they were 14, I think you could leave school around that time, with no qualifications and just did jobs to earn money because it's what the family had always done. And no one in my family had been to university. And so there was a sort of a mixed thing that they really encouraged the creativity to the point where it got to secondary school, I think. And I can tell why they would be thinking this, is they wanted me to do better than they did. So there was more encouragement. And I used to dread report days at school where they'd come back and they'd been to see the teachers and the teachers would just say, he needs to make more effort. And I think to say make more effort to someone that's struggling, I couldn't have made any more effort at school if I tried. I really couldn't. And so they were encouraging and I don't know, through that encouragement, maybe they didn't know. I didn't know who I was or anything. So it's really difficult to encourage someone that doesn't know who they are or don't want to do. Or don't know what they want to do.
And mm-hmm. You said this with 18, you left school and you started in a factory, but you did not end in the factory. You find your way into a management position. I think it wasn't the same company. Maybe you described this way because it sounds very, very, yeah, special.
Yeah, it's, and I said to you the other day when I spoke, Michael, it's, I'm always fascinated why people find this story interesting, because for me, it's just so ordinary. And it was, I spent 20 years in the same company and started as a temporary operator. It's in the pharmaceutical healthcare business, packing boxes. And I became just fascinated with the people on the shop floor, because early on, I remember we get shown an organization chart, and it'd show how the factory worked and who was in charge. And I used to look at that and then look at the shop floor and think, that's not how, these two things don't match. That mother hen lady over there on that packing line who's been here 40 years has more power and influence than anyone on this org chart.
Wow.
So I just became really interested in, and I would never have been able to describe it at this time, but just in relational processes and culture and how people interact and patterns of relationships. And that interest just meant that all I was doing was being interested in people. And people noticed this and then would put me in charge as a supervisor of teams and then as a manager of production operators. Because no one really wanted to work with production operators because they're a bit... there's no corporate jargon with a production operator. It's just most of them are just there to earn a bit of money. And so I used to get put in charge of problem teams, problem in inverted commas. And all I'd do was be interested in them. And the criticism I always used to get from people looking at my development would say, you're too pally, you're too friendly with the operators. You need to get some leadership distance. And I just thought, no, it doesn't feel right. Because I could get them to do whatever I wanted them to do. And I was able to manage boundaries with them. And this carried on for years and years of getting promoted and promoted, still within the factory, to the point when someone said to me, oh, you're good at this culture change, organization development work. Would you want to do that as a job? And I just thought, does that exist? Is that real? Yeah, all right. Sounds interesting. I don't think anyone that ends up in the world of organization development dreams of it as a child. You just sort of suddenly find yourself in it and go, oh, look, I'm this now. So I did a job at the factory. I was in charge in inverted commas, as if anyone could be in charge of culture. I was in charge of culture change at this factory for 5 or 6 years, large scale projects. But then I'm always restless with things, in that I get bored and I don't have much of an attention span. And so I just looked in the phone book one day and I thought, who's in charge of this stuff for the entire company? And there's this lady called Sally, who I often mention in interviews. And I sent her an email and I said, can I come to head office, buy you a coffee and just tell you about my work? And she was lovely. She said, yeah, of course you can. And so I went there, bought her a coffee, and she said, your work sounds fascinating. I was like thinking, really? I haven't trained in any of this. And I just said to her, look, I'll come and work for you for no extra money. I just want to come and hang out. And she did that. And then that was my move into like the big global role, really. So Sally really supported me, supported my development, supported me going to do some of my early group work training with the NTL Institute, paid for my master's program that I then did at Ashridge. Because I think in my 30s, I finally worked out what I was interested in. And then I took Sally's job when she left. And I left the company after 20 years as senior global director of leadership and development, mainly focusing in factories.
And you think this is an ordinary story?
Yeah,
you're kidding me.
But it's the only story I've lived, so that's why it seems ordinary to me. And, but again, all of it was around noticing what I'm interested in, finding out other people that are interested in it, and just making everything relational and not transactional.
What do you do today? Like, what's your, when you say the job today, the creative stuff today, how did you come into that?
Well, that was... So there's a shadow side to the factory story is throughout that whole time, or the whole corporate story, is throughout that whole time I had a massive imposter syndrome around getting senior roles without any qualifications in it. And just imagine with each like share package I'd get or promotion and becoming a director and all of those things, just thinking one day I'm going to get this phone call and they'll say, hold on a minute, we've just checked and you've got a D in A-level geography and that's it. So there was this whole imposter syndrome going along. And a really strong inner critic or superego just saying you're not good enough. Someone's going to find you out. And I'd always inhibit myself. And it was that NTL training that I just mentioned where that started to shift. So one of the first things I did with the NTL Institute was a thing called a T group, also known as a Tavistock group, which is, I think it's 16 of us sitting in a circle for 40 hours with no agenda. And it is just, it's just like a massive fractal mirror that screws with your head. And we went through all sorts of ups and downs in that, but you can't help in a T group but ask yourself the question of like, hold on, who am I? Who was that kid that used to do the bedroom DJs? What happened to him? What on earth am I doing around here? And it was that, the start of those insights led me to then have the confidence to go to Ashridge. And again, it was a guy called Professor Bill Critchley, again, spotted me and saw something in me that I didn't know. And he basically said, do you want to do the program? And he asked me for 3 years and I kept saying no. But the last year he said, I'm not going to ask you again. And because I'd done this development, I said, yep, okay, I'll do it. And Bill said, well, that was your interview, you're in. And then at Ashridge, the thing that I learned in Ashridge, I tried to write academically, or what I imagined academically, academic writing to be like, and it was awful. I mean, it probably would have got good marks in an MBA, and I'm not knocking MBAs, but the Ashridge program is a relational, reflective, philosophical exploration of everything. And Ashridge just gave me the confidence to, I don't know, in my own voice, the stuff that's ordinary to me may be of interest in others. And I wrote my dissertation on spontaneity and the idea that there is only the present moment, and got a massive mark for it. And when I was in my viva and they said, I've got one of the highest marks I've ever given a dissertation, bearing in mind it's my first academic qualification, I just burst into tears. So it was like in that moment, some of those demons died. And I went back to Sally and I said, I think I'm going to have to leave now because the world has just opened up. And so I worked part-time for the organisation for a bit and then went out on my own, mainly as a consultant for, I think I've been out on my own for almost 10 years now. Maybe 8 or 9 years. It all blurs when you get older, doesn't it? What day of the week it is, what year it is. And I started off mainly doing consulting around creativity and culture change in organisations. But I think the older, again, it's just been this thing of finding my voice and what's important to me. I'm doing less and less of that now because a lot of it just felt like going through the motions of organizations that aren't really interested in change. They're interested in the idea of change or creativity or innovation.
But they don't want to go the path. Yeah.
Yeah, that we want to change, we want to be game changers, but only within the rules of the current game. And so I sort of go into engagements with potential organizations now with the objective to try and put them off working with me, which isn't to, it honestly isn't coming from a position of arrogance. It's just that if we can't test that early on, that you're happy to work in this largely emergent, amorphous, live, slightly bonkers way, then it's not going to work. And at the moment during lockdown, because I think the majority of my work is I work with a handful of organizations that are really up for it, that are really up for doing immersive culture change, creative, subversive work. And then the rest of the time is speaking gigs. And when I had time in between, I'm an artist, so I produce paintings, drawings, I do conceptual art projects, which I can tell you about. But since lockdown, that's all I've been doing. And that's become thriving. I opened an Instagram art shop during lockdown and I could barely keep up with orders. So I'm starting to now think, actually, maybe I won't return to a lot of those things that I did before.
I can now definitely feel the connection. Also, when you said you're dyslexic and you have this imposter syndrome, and I have that. I certainly still have the feeling one day someone grabs me and pulls me from stage and says he does know what he's doing. Yeah, sometimes I think like I don't know what I'm capable of, so I can feel that. But the question that came to my mind, since you have 10 years ahead of me, so I want to know that now. How, because this, and that's very related to this topic of new work that we're into when it comes to situations when you have the feeling, I don't like that. I remember we had a neuroscientist in the podcast. He said, we are naturally designed to move away from things that give us discomfort.
Yeah.
And like move towards things that give us comfort. But we kind of overcame this feeling because we're so distracted by many things. And I find it very challenging sometimes to express my feelings. I know that when I have a discussion with Michael, and Michael is like, oh, that's easy, that's black and white, why don't you do this and go this way? And then I can feel that we're so different in characters. And I kind of, it's hard to explain. It's more like I see a certain color, but I cannot express the exact color. It's very hard for me sometimes to do that. How did you navigate through this thing? Because, I mean, looking backwards, it's sometimes easier. And this could help some people who have a tiny little feeling about, oh, that doesn't feel right, I don't go this path.
Yeah. It's, I don't have a formula for it. I'm not entirely sure how I do it, if I'm being totally honest. But for me, it's something around a real trust in gut feel or intuition that I couldn't really describe. I mean, the thing, there's this sort of weird thing in the world, isn't there, that if you don't have a word for something, it doesn't exist. Yet nature's got away with that for years, and nature seems to be doing all right. And the fact that something doesn't have a word doesn't mean it doesn't exist. But for me, it's an instinct. It's a gut feel. It's like that moment when I sent the email to Sally. Was just, I don't know why I'm doing this. It would be much, it's almost like split personality where my logic is saying, well, no, don't do that. Don't rock the boat. Don't. But my instinct is saying, this is important. And right from the moment I handed in my notice to leave that organization, my inner critic and my thoughts were going, this is ridiculous. You're getting way ahead of yourself here. You're not as good as you think. But again, it's just an instinct thing. It's like during... And again, it's that instinct that's really helping during lockdown. It's just trusting that I'm acting from a position of, I don't know, this feels important. It feels like important stuff to do. And then there's another thing, which is knowing which stuff doesn't feel right because it doesn't feel right. And again, that, I think that's what it is. There's two sides to the question, Christoph, to the answer. Is one is trusting gut feel for stuff that doesn't quite make sense. And the other is trusting gut feel for stuff that just doesn't smell right. And I've made that mistake early on with bits of work that I've done as an associate. And it's why I don't do associate work anymore. Where someone's offered me a piece of work and I'd be thinking, well, yeah, I could do with the money. But there's something in my gut feel saying, no, this is bad. Do not go near it. And I've ended up trapped in a couple of pieces of work that were just horrible, that I didn't want to do, that the people didn't want to do. And I think it's a trial and error thing, isn't it? But there's a couple of sort of, not mantras, but things that sort of guide me. One is to move towards that which I'd rather avoid. I mean, that's what I think the conundrum of creativity is. If I'm interested in creativity in the human condition being what you described as our desire to move away from the unfamiliar, creativity being our seeking of the novel. And they're in this perpetual battle, like Tom and Jerry, it never ends. And I think that moving away from the unfamiliar tends to always win out. So I'm just trying to trust a little bit more, just a little bit more. And it's to not confuse fear of death and injury and suppression of others with something that's just that superego, that inner critic voice. So I don't know if that answers anything or just adds more layers of confusion.
No, not at all. Something comes to my mind. Related to that, from an entrepreneur, I'm searching the name. Give me 1 second. Star office. Marco Böris. He's from Northern Germany as well, and I saw him once. He's quite a successful entrepreneur, and there's one quote that he left me with, which I remember. It said, "Sense will always make sense. Nonsense will always stay nonsense." Yeah. And some people say like, hey, this doesn't make sense. And I can feel how this makes sense because you move towards something that gives you a little bit more challenge. Like you push the comfort zone a little bit more and a little bit more. I mean, creativity definitely needs that. I remember I had that with Michael's movie last year when we made the documentary about the movie. It was definitely one step out of the comfort zone, but this opened up a whole new world. And at the same time, you have these moments. And I think that is important for many people to know this is nonsense what we're here doing now. Yeah. So let's leave that. Like let's step away from that. It's nonsense because we sometimes have certain ways to keep nonsense going. And this is the big opportunity I definitely see also with this situation here right now, because everyone is pushed against the boundary of his or her comfort zone, and some people far beyond that. But we now see many things that make absolutely no sense at all.
Yeah. Well, I love the idea of sense and nonsense. And I think occasionally we get the words around the wrong way. So I'm really interested in moving towards nonsense, because the things, because the things we describe as sense are just stuck patterns, obviously. It's like, I often describe the projects I do, particularly the conceptual art projects, like the Silent Podcast and the Inexpert thing, which was I can tell you about, is they're designed to do the opposite of common sense, because common sense is stuck. And it may be helpful. There's a common sense way of crossing the road that doesn't guarantee, but makes it likely that you won't get run over. But if we're trying to get out of a situation, then the same common sense that got us into it won't get us out of it. So there's something around, there's a radar of, is this nonsense or is this, this is nonsense. This is really interesting stuff. This is how change happens. And this is where my interest in perpetually being an outsider comes in. And the interest started first getting into the outsider art movement, people like Jean de Buffet that in post-war Europe started bringing to light all of these outsider artists, the untrained, passionate weirdos. And when you look at their art, you couldn't describe, I couldn't describe why I like it, but there's just something in it. There's something in it. There's something beautifully wonky in it, because it doesn't make sense, because they haven't trained in a normal way. And one of the sayings that I have in all of my projects is to start before I'm ready. And I always say that to someone. If it feels really important, start before you're ready. So I know if I wait too long, I'll talk myself out of it. And that's what I like about social media, is I'll come up with an idea and I'll put it out there and then I can't back out of it, really. Or it's more awkward too.
Let's dive into one or two of your art projects. As it has the name podcast and we're doing podcast, I really stumbled over the Silent Podcast. Maybe you explain a little bit, how did you come up with this idea? How does it really work to ask people to do a podcast where they can't speak? And how, what did it make with your community you have and the people to which are listening to it?
Yeah. So Sound of Silence is... all of my projects just start. It tends to be when I'm out running. When I'm out running, I'll just suddenly have an idea and then I get back and I have to act on that idea. And I think there's something about running. I often joke that my inner critic can't keep up with me because he's not fit enough. So I have freedom of thought. But I think there is a physiological effect from running. And just before I went running, someone sent me a link to a podcast. And I'm not, again, I'll say this to you guys, I'm not anti-podcast. What provoked my thought pattern was the amount of podcasts that are exactly the same. And I just thought, oh, not another one. And it was some podcast on leadership hacks. And I just thought, what would the opposite of a podcast be? Why are we so obsessed with downloading distraction rather than stuff that is actually nutritional? It's like just like eating fast food all the time. And it always starts like that. So the thought pattern is, what would the opposite of a podcast be? What would be nothing? What if you could download nothing? Yeah, you could download nothing, like that John Cale record that was 4 minutes 33 or whatever it was. And wouldn't it be brilliant if there's a podcast that just had nothing on it? And it would be great. What if I had some real high profile special guests, like real top end people, and they were all recorded face to face? And then it just goes from there. And literally, I got back from the run. I registered the domain Sound of Silence, which was a working title. My working titles always end up as the actual title. And then that was it. It just started from there. And it was difficult to get started, first of all, because most people that I wrote to thought it was a joke. And particularly like reasonably well-known people, their agents would see it and go, nah, this is a joke. So I just started with well-known people that I knew, like Sam Conniff, who wrote Be More Pirate, is a friend of mine. There's some eminent psychotherapists I know. My friend Fred Deakin, who used to be in the band Lemon Jelly. So they all said yes. And it started to, it's like, all right, if these people are doing it. And then I found the form early on. The form of the podcast is each episode is no longer than 3.5 minutes, ideally less than 3 minutes. It starts with a little jingle. Then there's me, say, I'll say, welcome to Sound of Silence. Today's guest is so-and-so. And then I'll say a little bit about them, which just builds up the intrigue. It's like, normally you'd say that and explore it, but I just say it and then leave it hanging. And then I'll welcome them and they say hello. And then we sit in silence for 2 minutes. And at the end of the silence, I say, thank you for joining me. And they say, thank you. And that's the end of an episode. And that's it.
I love it.
But early on, there was something missing. And this is still evolving, this project. I put out an episode weekly for 90 weeks. And I've only got a few more left to record, which I'll tell you about in a minute. And so I've just had to sort of slow it down because of COVID, because I can't get out to record them. But early on, I started putting them out and people were listening and people were saying, this is stupid, this is ridiculous. And I for every 100 bits of positive praise, I'll get one bit of criticism. And that's the bit that I remember. It's familiar. I still remember the day I launched it, a tweet from someone I didn't know, but had lots of followers, said, this is ridiculous, podcasts have jumped the shark. And that my immediate thought then was, oh, maybe I should stop this. Maybe it isn't good. But I kept going. But something was missing. And it didn't feel like one of my projects. And then I thought, it doesn't have an end point. That's why I'm really interested in impermanence and designing a way to end well right at the beginning, or stopping something at its peak. There's the legend of the British comedy 40 Towers, that they only made like 10 episodes or something, and because they didn't want it to come off its peak. So I decided about a year and a half ago that there would only be 100 episodes. And so it would have an end point. And from that point on, it became more than a silent podcast. It's like each episode was progressing towards an end point. It made each one more valuable. The point when I crossed over from episode 49 to 51 was like a moment of when, as a Western man, I think it's when you cross over from about 38 to 39, there's less left statistically than there was. And so this whole having an end point really changed the project. And then it's just been some bizarre moments. I've met some of my heroes. So David Shrigley's, I'm a big fan of him as an artist. And I went down to his studio in Brighton and recorded Silence with him. There's a British comedian called Vic Reeves, who I went down to his house. And you may have heard of him from, you may remember him from the news, Michael, a guy called Terry Waite, who was held hostage in Beirut in the late 80s, I think. And I went to Terry's house in Suffolk and spent the entire day with him in his house talking about his captivity, his torture, silence, religion, life. But what's brilliant is I spent an entire afternoon with Terry. He made me soup and everything. And then the bit we record, there's nothing. And I just like the bizarreness of it.
Und hier kommt ein ganz kurzer Blocker, der aber eher ein Aufruf für etwas Großartiges ist, was ihr euch anschauen könnt. Als Filmemacher und Michaels Podcast-Partner hatte ich die Chance, letztes Jahr die Hyrox-Doku zu machen. Es war für mich echt ein großes Geschenk. Wir durften emotional in das Erlebnis eintauchen, was dort diese unfassbare Veranstaltung bietet. Und jetzt gibt es etwas Neues, und zwar ein Film, den Michaels Team gemacht hat. Auf der Hyrox-Seite findet ihr auf YouTube, wenn ihr nach Hyrox World sucht. Dort findet ihr den Film mit dem Titel Never Stop Competing, und der ist so geil, der ist so gut, es lohnt sich drauf zu gucken. Und ich befürchte, nachdem unsere Doku die meistgeschaute war, wird das definitiv ablösen, was wir gemacht haben. Ist für mich eine neue Challenge, was nachzulegen, aber schaut euch den unbedingt an, das vermittelt ein so geiles Gefühl dieses Events. Und wie ihr wisst, in Corona-Zeiten, Hyrox als Mass Participation Event ist natürlich auch betroffen. Und es gibt jetzt aber die Möglichkeit, sich für die neue Saison anzumelden. Es wird dort weitergehen. Es gibt außerdem auch Challenges, die ihr zu Hause machen könnt. Aber gebt euch einfach einmal bitte diesen geilen Film auf YouTube, Hyrox World, und dann einfach nach Never Stop Competing. Richtig, richtig geil.
Yeah, but I think I'm thinking of moments with friends or people I really love or like in silence. Because everything was said, and every additional word would destroy the situation. And I barely can name a number of situations where I had this feeling, but I remember that this feeling is always amazing.
It's always this very intimate moment when you pause and someone has the feeling, I have to say something, or you just leave it. And then you actually get the feeling of, okay, how intimate is this situation really? And I mean, sitting in a few moments of silence with friends and just do nothing. And even for someone who listens, it's a gift, because that's a pause. It's definitely pause. And as I said, I have a hard time to like put words into feelings, but I definitely can see a picture that you painted of that idea. And I definitely understand it. Same with the critics, which would be a question I would have, because I have the same thing. I hear the critics always very loud. And the thing that helps me with that is this continuity to keep going. That's why I showed you this create thing. It's to me, it's not ready. It's something I have to do. I have to keep going, and that's what helps me. But I hear them very loud when they speak, which is sad, because there are way more people saying good things about it. Yeah. How's that with you? Like, how do you deal with it, and what does that tell you about yourself?
It's people often say, how comes you're so comfortable with uncertainty, or how comes you're so comfortable with not knowing? And I always point out that that's not true. It's just a familiar discomfort.
Mm.
It's a familiar discomfort. And I use the analogy of, I get costochondritis, which is cartilage pain in the ribs. It's completely harmless condition, but it just causes pain in the ribs. And every time I get it, it is the same discomfort, but it's a familiar discomfort. So I know it's not something else. And I think that's what I'm learning to do with all of this, is it just becomes a familiar discomfort. So I did a talk in 2016, I think, and it's got like, I don't know, 160,000 views and thousands of likes, but it's got 14 thumbs down. And I know exactly that there's 14 thumbs down. And if another one appears, I'll just suddenly think, oh no, this is really bad. I think it's just that noticing, just hold on a minute and just letting it be.
Mm.
And just think, this is a familiar discomfort. It will pass. It's of interest. And this is where I think this whole idea of, and ironically, that talk that I mentioned was about the inner critic. But I think there's this myth that you defeat this when you become a fully functioning adult, all of these voices go and you're just this omnipotent, bulletproof person. But I think that's a myth. I think that's what happens if you numb out of the raw experience of life. Whereas I have a good friend who's a Zen monk, and she'd say, just roll it all in, whatever it is, roll it all in. Stick with not knowing, sit with not knowing, and just allow it to be. And again, there's something in that is, because it doesn't have an end point, because it's not tangible, because it's difficult to describe, most people would find that unsatisfactory, which is why people wouldn't think that's a helpful way of being. But for me, it's rolling it all in and just thinking, oh, it's that again. It's that self-doubt again.
It's just, I think just have the sentence of Viktor Frankl in my mind, the guy who wrote Man's Search for Meaning.
Yeah.
And I think he had a sentence, I cannot quote it, but it's something like, if you give conscious to the pain, then the pain loses its power over you. Because you go one step away and you look on yourself from a certain stage, and then you realize it's my task to give this purpose to whatever is happening, and not the other way around. And that really pops up to my mind right now when you say that. It's the mechanism that you describe of this discomfort.
And I think that's the thing that I'd say to people that are interested in that, is to find your own way of dancing with it. To not do battle with it, but to find your own way of dancing with it. And for me, it's through art and tactile things.
Mm.
It's like when I don't know what to draw, I'll just draw not knowing what to draw. And then somehow I know what to draw, because I've drawn not knowing what to draw. And I started years ago drawing pictures of my inner critic and superego. And before I'd go into a talk or a workshop, I'd always be thinking that it's going to be terrible, everyone's going to hate it. So I used to draw that scenario. And they'd be like, all these big, tough, burly men in suits throwing bricks at me. And it's just by externalizing it, you can see how ludicrous it is. And you can also see some grains of truth in it as well. And that's where I think that dance, or doing Tai Chi with your self-doubt, I think it's much more, I find it much more nurturing. Because the whole structure of the inner critic was originally designed to protect us, to maintain human contact earlier on. Because when you're a tiny baby, that contact from parents or key carers is vital. So you don't want to do something to be rejected. But then it just gets distorted later in life, I think. But there's always a grain of truth somewhere in it. So it's why I dislike all these ideas of slay the inner critic or destroy the inner critic, because that just feels like a form of psychological self-harm to me. I'm beating up a part of me that is distorted but trying to protect me.
I have, when I read through your CV, I stumbled over two aspects. One is that you did an education as an art therapist, and the second one is the Gestalt topic. How did those two things influence your work, and how maybe helped it you to combine your creative part and your interest in human beings?
Yeah. Well, the art therapy thing is quite a short story. For years, I thought about training as a therapist, and all of my therapist friends, and I know a weird amount of therapists, would always say, you can, but I don't think that's what you're looking for. I think therapy will teach you a way to do things, and what it seems that you're good at is finding out new ways. So I did the foundation program in art therapy. So I never went on to do the full program. And that was great because in my imagination, it was all this, and it is an incredible body of work, art therapy. But through going through the foundation training, I could see my own way of working in this way. So it sort of just gave me that confidence. It's weird. So I learned more about my own form of therapeutic art by not going on to do the whole program. But the Gestalt thing has been an interest of mine for years, right back when I did some coaching training, probably in my early 20s, and Gestalt was mentioned, and I didn't understand what the hell they were on about, which always intrigues me. It's like, it's that nonsense radar. It's like, I don't understand this, but it sounds like beautiful nonsense. And so over the years, I've done lots of little bits of training and reading in Gestalt, purely because for me, Gestalt is a philosophy and psychology of the present moment. There is only now. It's why I have an interest in Zen as well. I'm not religious, but I have a huge interest in Zen. And a lot of the Gestalt and Zen philosophy underpins or sits at the heart of all of my work. Again, it's why I became interested in improvisation and spontaneity, because there is only the present moment. You can't exist in anything other than the present moment. So the only way you can make any change is in the present moment. And the thing I love at the heart of Gestalt psychology is it's paradoxical. So there's a thing called the paradoxical theory of change that a guy called Arne Beiser came up with. And the paradoxical theory of change, or at least my version of it, is you get more change by becoming more deeply aware of who you are right now than you do by trying to be something you're not. So just by deepening awareness of things as they are now, just to roll that in and allow that to be, gives us a greater range of choice in the next moment we find ourselves living. And that makes so much sense to me. There's nothing wrong with future-focused work and goals and strategies and all of that. I mean, I was trained in Lean Six Sigma in the factory. I know how to make something efficient. But it's a different thing. And I think that underpins everything. I think that it allows me to be better with not knowing. It allows me to better to dance with things as they are. And yeah, so that's just become a really important part. And the thing I love about Gestalt is I've been in and around the Gestalt world for like 20 years, and I still can't properly describe it, but I like that.
Cool. Thank you.
From what I feel right now is that that anything, or let's say like, okay, let's put it to a question. You see, I have hard time to like express my feelings. What is distraction for you? Like, what is distraction and what is valuable input that you need for your work?
That's a really good question. For me, I think I'm learning more and more about myself as I get older. And if I can't find a state of flow where I'm just immersed in something. Like, I've no idea how long we've been talking now. I'm just here, or creating a piece of artwork or something. I'm totally immersed in it. And anything that we might call a distraction, I can use. I was doing some paper cuts the other day, and then I suddenly noticed that the outside of a bit that I'd cut off actually looked like a really brilliant picture in itself. So I'll go off and make that. So that may be a distraction. But for me, things like, I find noise a huge distraction. And it took me a year and a half to realize, hold on, maybe that's why I'm doing a silent podcast. I didn't think that, but maybe that's why. And there's a whole condition called misophonia, which I don't know if you've come across, which is an irrational reaction to noise, but only certain types of noise. And it's why I've got these soundproof things in here, because there are certain noises that I find distracting and I can't tune out of. And I think that comes with when you nurture a creative mind or just liberate this. I think it's also associated with dyslexia and forms of autism as well, which I suspect I'm somewhere on that scale. Not being able to tune out of some distractions like that, I find really difficult, really anxiety provoking. And I can't function. I just want to, I chat with a therapist regularly, and not my own therapist, rather than my mates that are therapists. And it just makes me want to, it's like it triggers that fight or flight response in me. So I don't know if that was the type of thing you was getting at, but I find that a distraction. But other than that, I don't know. It's, if I'm in the right environment, and it's where, I mean, people on the podcast won't be able to see it, but this environment that I'm in, my little studio, I mean, it's tiny, but I can just get lost in here. There are loads of distractions in here, just like books and random bits. There's half a doll's head up there that I don't know where that came from, and a puppet that I made. So there are welcome distractions as well.
If you could do some shots with your phone and send it to us, I would love put them to the story. Thank you.
Yeah.
In times of like Corona these days, and it's a big media distraction as well. We had that a couple of weeks ago. Michael and I were talking about, and Michael said this is the most successful media campaign in history of mankind, because like there's nothing that has this stage as it has right now. But what do you feel when it comes to not only the opportunity, but also the distraction about it, like pulling away from important stuff?
Do you mean specifically for Corona?
For the situation everyone is in right now.
For me, it works okay. And I always hesitate to say that, because I want to caveat and say, of course, I wouldn't want this situation. And I appreciate that people are in a much, much worse situation. But for me, it's almost removed the distractions for me. It's removed. I realized, I wrote a blog about it recently, that I realized that because it shouldn't be comforting, because I'm earning hardly any money other than selling little bits of art. And I always make my art affordable, so it doesn't earn me a lot. But as I was going through my diary, deleting big paid pieces of work, I thought, this is so nice. This is lovely. And I was really confused, because I thought, I should be really scared because I'm deleting my earnings. But I realized that the fact that I can't do anything about it, I literally can't, meant that there was a guilt and anxiety lifted, a guilt and anxiety that I didn't know was there every single day. So I think there may be another level of distractions. Is, I think money messes everything up for me. And it's a necessity for the way in which we live our lives. So I don't make money necessarily evil. But just the removal of that responsibility, that I don't know, that the whole COVID lockdown has allowed me to remove some self-imposed guilt and anxiety around stuff. And I think I deliberately ration distraction in this time. I will only do one virtual call a day between 9:30 and 5. Although I make exceptions for people that give me energy. I reply to maybe 2 emails a day, and I will only listen to the daily briefing on the news. And even though they've got a bit dull now, so I'll avoid them. Because I think you can be oversaturated, and it's literally broadcasting not knowing the entire time.
Yeah.
And I think there's some particular things about COVID that are different to other human experiences. If you think of war and things like that, I mean, you look out the window and there aren't bombs falling or houses on fire. And So it doesn't look like anything's going on unless you're in the front line, like some of my in-laws are. But the other thing is, you can't other this. In a war situation or a dictatorship, you can other it. I mean, we've seen it in the UK, and it's the only time I'll mention Brexit. We've seen it here. The othering of those that voted one thing are all this, those that voted the other thing are all this, and irrelevant of where you stand on it. That generalized other just makes things wrong. But we can't do that with a virus, even though people will try to pin it on China, the US, whoever. So I think just for us to get good at not knowing together and not knowing be okay is probably more helpful than all this distraction of constant news and updates and info. I mean, obviously some tangible stuff. Stay 2 meters apart or whatever it is. Only travel when necessary. Some instructional stuff that's helpful, but the rest is just, I don't know. I don't know how you can fill a news channel with nothing for so long. I find it hard enough to do a 2 minute silent podcast. It's...
yeah, but you have a good way, like, because there are some words that you find that I find hard to express. I definitely can see that you have the 10 years ahead of me. I really appreciate that, because I kind of feel similar to the situation and to many things that you said and mentioned already. So this is also why, for example, when my gigs were canceled, I had kind of the same feeling. So like, okay, I cannot do anything about it. So I turned something out of it. I just change and do something, but I don't freak out about it.
Yeah.
And I can feel you have the same.
So it's weird. It's freedom within constraint. Whereas before I had constraint within freedom. I'm still making sense of it, and I don't totally want to make sense of it. But it's worked for me and how my brain works. I said to my therapist, it's almost like the world's working on my terms at the moment. Yes, I wouldn't want all the death and suffering. And at the same time, in my day-to-day experience, the world's working for me. It's quieter. It's no one's asking me to do anything. I can make stuff, and if it doesn't go anywhere, then fine.
The question I have all the time is, can scorpions smoke?
Right.
for everyone who doesn't see you, that's the question that is behind you on your wall. Can scorpions smoke?
That's become a really interesting thing. That started when I was writing my dissertation. So I wrote my dissertation on spontaneity when I was at Ashridge. And part of my research, rather than just reading loads of books on spontaneity, I trained in performance improvisation, and I would go and do shows and classes. And there was one show that I was in where I ended up on stage with a partner, and they started to pretend to drive a car, so I sat next to them, so we're in a car. So the scene is how it works in improvisation. The scene is building by the different little tiny offers. And I just started to pretend to play with the windows, because I thought, well, I don't know what to do in a car. And then the person sitting next to me said, well, stop playing with the windows. You're always really annoying on these long road trips. So again, that's the scene established. And this is how my projects work. I work out what they are as they go along. So I thought, oh, I must be a bored passenger. So I started just asking these stupid questions, like, how deep is space? What do dogs dream of? And all of those types of things. And it's all, you get into improv, a thing called the game of the scene, where the game was, I would ask these stupid questions, the passenger would get more and more annoyed, and it keeps fueling that to the point of being ridiculous. And then I just fired off a number of questions, and then I just suddenly asked, can scorpions smoke? And in that moment, I thought, I have absolutely no idea where that came from. It just suddenly came out in such a weird way. I think all of the other things I'd slightly thought about, and it just came out, and the person sitting next to me just completely corpsed, like couldn't stop laughing. And then the director of the scene just said, and scene. And I just thought, I do not know where that came from. And someone said to me, you should call your dissertation, Can Scorpions Smoke? And so I thought, I like that. I like my dissertation being in the hallowed halls of Ashridge that would all have these very sensible titles. And then there's one called Can Scorpions Smoke? So that's where it came from. And then I named my blog Can Scorpion Smoke, because I still had lots to write about after my dissertation. And then I also, my business is registered as Can Scorpion Smoke. So when the UK tax man writes to me, he says, Dear Can Scorpion Smoke Limited. And that's where it came from. I'm not, I mean, I like all animals. I'm not a massive fan of scorpions, and I don't smoke, but It leads for some interesting search engine results. Quite a lot of people end up on my blog because they've searched for, can you smoke scorpions?
Okay, I like that. But the small thing that you mentioned, it came to you in a certain moment and you have no clue where it came from. And that's exactly the point. I love that. I think in Indian tradition, people say thinking is just another skill, like, how do you say, like sense, like viewing, like listening, like smelling. And thinking is, it just comes to you. You cannot claim you think a certain thing. And people tend to think, yeah, but thinking makes me the person I am and I can do the strategic thinking. But there are too many things just popping into our head and we cannot control them. But we think we can control them. And I think that's the big the big misconception. Well, at least that's what I feel.
No, absolutely. And I think getting comfortable with the fact that everything is spontaneous action. Yeah. Alan Watts used to speak about this in his lectures. He'd say, but then people say, no, but I chose to think that. And he'd say to them, well, so, but when did you choose to think that?
Yeah.
And when did you choose to choose to think that? And then you realize everything comes out of nothing at some level. Yeah. And there's, I think it's being open to offers. And this is where the improviser's mindset can be really helpful. There's a guy called Arnie Mindell, who I think was a quantum physicist. And I learned this secondhand, so I don't know if it's what he meant, but he had this idea of quantum flirting. Quantum flirting being, normally with our rather egotistical human brains, we'd think, I choose to notice this bottle over here, or I choose to notice this tree out the window. Whereas in the quantum world, what Mindell was talking about was, no, that thing called for your attention in that moment. And which is, it doesn't make sense, which again is why I like it. And I think my creative practice works in this way. And I encourage others, if I'm doing coaching work with them, is instead of seeking an answer, be open to it presenting itself to you, but don't go looking for it. If you go looking for it, you won't find it, but be open to something presenting itself to you. And it's weird because stuff does. So many times recently when I've just been doing something in here and I'll write something down on a picture, and at the very same time I'm writing that word will come on a song on my Spotify playlist. And there's so much more interconnectivity between things. The animals must look at us and go, how can those idiots still be around? They experience such a narrow slice of existence. But yeah, being open to, don't go looking, be open to something presenting itself to you. It's a different way of being, I think.
Mm. Nice. I love it. I think we're hitting the hour. Yeah. If I look on the watch.
Right. But Steve, what I said when we talked last week, I think Christoph will have the same feeling. We would love to do a second episode with you when the time is back that we can travel. We would love to visit you somewhere around London. But first of all, we would love to thank you for this incredible hour. It was even better than I thought it will be. Thank you so much. You really touched me, amazed me. I could laugh and cry in the same minute. And I'm a happy man for this day. Thank you.
Well, thank you. So I've totally lost myself in this, which is always a wonderful thing.
Exactly the same thing I had. So I'm very happy for this very spontaneous introduction, and I'm never prepared for these sessions. So this was a big gift and surprise on a Monday morning.
Good. Thank you, guys. And I'll see you in face to face at some point.
Thank you.